Morris Cranston was associated with LSE for nearly 35 years and held the established chair of political science from 1969 until his retirement in 1985. Many of you knew him well, and like me, will have your own memories of Morris's friendship, his warmth, his courtesy, sense of humor, his thoughtfulness. These sentiments were expressed very well at the memorial service held at St. George's Bloomsbury in February of last year. This afternoon, we hope to remember Morris in an academic way, as a colleague at LSE and a leading citizen of the Republic of Letters. It will be exactly 30 years ago next month, just as I was completing my PhD thesis, that Morris suggested that I go to University College London to chat with James Burns, to chat about an opening as research assistant on the edition of the collected works of Jeremy Bentham, which were then beginning to take shape. The salary, I believe, was £950. There were other openings. Politics departments were springing up in all sorts of universities. But Morris took a firm line, not about Bentham, but that no one should want to leave London voluntarily. Now, I have many reasons to be grateful for his advice, on this as on numerous other occasions. And one reason is the opportunity that I have now to introduce Professor Burns' lecture this afternoon. Those who've studied the history of political thought will need no introduction to his numerous writings and distinguished editorial work from the medieval period onwards. He is Emeritus Professor of the History of Political Thought in the University of London and still chairs with good humor the long-established seminar in that field at the Institute of Historical Research. His publications are listed on the sheet on your seats. I should mention his forthcoming book, The True Law of Kingship, Concepts of Monarchy in Early Scotland. The title of today's lecture is Libera Communitas, The Problem of Constituent Power. Professor Burns.
It is, I hardly need to say, but I do say, it is a privilege and an honor to have been invited to deliver this lecture in memory of Morris Cranston. We were, of course, colleagues as teachers in the University of London for much the period that Fred Rosen has just mentioned. We were almost exact contemporaries, so I think that Morris was slightly my senior in the service of the university. But of course I was aware of his work before I migrated from Aberdeen to London, where, apparently in accordance with his advice, I've remained ever since. I knew of his work before I migrated from Scotland to London in the winter of 1960-61. And indeed, our first indirect contact took place while I was still in Scotland. It arose, I have to admit, from a measure of disagreement over the interpretation of the ideas, or some of the ideas, of John Stuart Mill. This was in the pages of the periodical History Today, where Morris's article, J.S. Mill as a Political Philosopher, appeared in January 1958. My rejoinder to that article embroiled me, not, I hasten to say, with the author, but with an indignant Norfolk schoolmaster who found some of my conclusions less weighty than they at first appear. Leaving that aside, I hasten on to my next and more direct contact with Morris Cranston himself. This took place in the early 1960s, and as I shall reveal later, it again involved a degree of disagreement. But it's more important to say that that meeting marked the beginning of a friendly association which managed to bridge the gap. And as you know, it's a gap that is not merely geographical in its dimensions, the gap between Gower Street and Houghton Street. The point of contact on that occasion lay again in the work and ideas of a notable political writer of the past. Having become dissatisfied with the then current translations of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Du Contrat Social, I had perhaps rashly embarked on making my own English version. And only when I had proceeded in that hazardous enterprise some way into book two did I learn that Morris had contracted to make and would in due course publish the translation which in 1958 was added to the Penguin Classic series. This discovery led in due course to our meeting here in the school over lunch to discuss some of the problems that beset those who assume the translator's role. I still have, indeed I have it with me here this evening, the signed copy of Morris's translation on which he had written with characteristic generosity, inscribed for James Burns, with much gratitude by the translator. The gratitude, I have to say, was based on less than total accord as to the rendering of Rousseau's text, and there will be a relevant occasion in the course of this lecture to return to one point of difference on which I may say now I not only failed to persuade Morris that my view was right, but have since failed signally to persuade anybody else. Obstinately, I persist, as the poet says, in my long-standing fallacies. But what mattered more, I think, as a result of that first meeting and our subsequent meetings, was, if I may say this, a mutual recognition of a commitment to certain scholarly values, and I should think better of myself than I do if I could be confident that I've attained anything like the integrity in that commitment, which was characteristic of the scholar whose memory we have met here to honour this evening. Freedom, as I hardly need to remind this audience, was a central concern for Morris Cranston, both in his own thinking and in his work on other thinkers. No one, after all, could study in depth the ideas and the lives of John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and indeed of John Stuart Mill, without thinking seriously about the nature of freedom and its relation to social and political authority. It's true that the freedom with which I shall be attempting to deal in this lecture may seem to have less to do with personal liberty as with what Thomas Hobbes had in mind when he observed, "The liberty whereof there is so frequent and honorable mention in the histories and philosophy of the ancient Greeks and Romans is not the liberty of particular men, but the liberty of the commonwealth." Now, the liberty which characterizes a libera communitas or a liber populus is, of course, a corporate liberty. But it need not and it should not be construed in isolation or abstraction from the freedom of those individuals who make up those societies. Both civic and civil liberty, I suggest, are necessary elements in the freedom that is claimed for the human individual. That must suffice as my case for regarding the subject I've chosen this evening as at least not wholly inappropriate to this commemorative occasion. My exploration of the theme will certainly take us some considerable distance away from the periods and the intellectual worlds with which Morris Cranston's work was for the most part concerned, though I shall return to those periods and those worlds in a later part of the lecture. Nevertheless, I think that the exploration of this theme, going back into that earlier period, may begin, at least, in the 18th century Enlightenment, and with a figure with whose voluminous works I was greatly concerned at the time when I first met Maurice Cranstoun. But I turned to Jeremy Bentham not primarily as an exponent of the idea or concept of constituent power, but because he faced in the 1780s a problem which led me eventually in the direction that I'm proposing to take this evening. What I have called and shall call throughout this lecture constituent power and the problem of constituent power arises when, and only when, a definitive notion of constitutional structure, specifically of constitutional law, has emerged and taken shape. And this, in its turn, prompts questionings as to the source and basis of that constitutional structure or constitutional law. Now, the term constitutional law had not established itself with any firmness in general usage at the time, in the early 1780s, when Bentham encountered the problem to which I've referred. He was writing, for reasons that needn't concern us here, in the manuscripts I'm referring to, in French. And he was writing in order to establish the shape, to design, the form of the panomion, the code of law complete in all its branches, which was already his goal at that time and was to retain that position throughout the half century of life that still lay ahead of him. Writing in French then, he discovered that one of the forms of law with which his code would have to deal, which his code would have to include, was commonly referred to as droit politique. He thought this was an unsatisfactory term and argued that it should be replaced by the term droit constitutionnel. Now, there's evidence to suggest that already in French usage, a change of that kind was taking place, but it was not until 1835 that the new term, droit constitutionnel, earned the accolade of inclusion in the French Academy's authoritative dictionary. It's to the older term, the term droit politique, and its English equivalent, politic law, that I want to direct your attention. This was, I must emphasize, a term of art in the political discourse of 18th century Europe. That was why Bentham, although he disliked the term, nevertheless adopted it, accepted it as being the standard way of referring to a particular category of law. And that category of law was, as Robert Derrate pointed out 40 years ago, equivalent to what was to become known in German as Allgemeines Staatsrecht and in French as droit public général. One of the most important instances of the use of this term, droit politique, is to be found in the posthumously published work of Jean-Jacques Bourlamaquis, entitled Principe du droit politique, duly Englished by the indefatigable Thomas Nugent as Principles of Politic Law. I shall return in due course to Bourlamaquis, once I've established as fully as I can in the available time the direction of the argument that I want to develop in this lecture. But for the moment, I want to draw your attention to the fact that that phrase, principe du droit politique, will, I suspect, seem more familiar to some people here tonight than its use by Bourlamaquis would explain. And the reason why we find it familiar is, of course, that it was the phrase used by Rousseau as the subtitle of Du Contrat Social. The subtitle is precisely Principe du droit politique. Now, in that context, it has commonly been translated as Principles of Political Right. And indeed, that is how you will find it translated on the title page of Morris's edition. I've thought for many years that principles of political right is a very strange phrase, and one which I suggest no one writing in English, certainly in modern English, would use unless the exigencies of translation seem to impose its necessity. And they do not, I want to argue, impose any such necessity at all. It's true that in dealing with a phrase of this kind, we are handicapped by lacking or by no longer retaining in English the fruitful nuances that in other European languages have arisen from the duality of jus and lex, of droit and loi, of recht and gesetz. It's also true that Rousseau was undoubtedly concerned above all, to tell his readers what was right. But the rightness was to be embodied in law. The valid principles that he sought to expound and defend were to be expressed in the political institutions which were to have been the subject of the abortive treaties Du Contrat Social was originally written to introduce. And it was on these grounds that in the meeting to which I've referred, and perhaps in further meetings I can't now remember, I tried vainly, as I've acknowledged, to persuade Maurice Cranstoun that the correct English subtitle of Rousseau's book is Principles of Constitutional Law. Now, as I say, not only did I fail to persuade Maurice, I've never succeeded in persuading anybody else. And I mustn't trespass upon your patience by flogging a dead horse or pursuing a wild goose. Instead, what I've said now is really just intended to explain how it was that, having failed to persuade others to join me in those activities, pleasurable though they are, I turned instead to explore the earlier history of this term politic law, or politic laws. Now here, I go back to the 16th century, the period in which, to use words that John Knox used in a rather more spiritual connection, the period where I first cast anchor. Indeed, briefly at one point, I shall invite you to go a little further back even than that, a century or so into what we conventionally call the Middle Ages. But it is from a text of the early 16th century that I've taken the title of this lecture, and it's to a text written towards the end of that century that I turn at this point. In the early months of 1582, Ninian Winyat, an early adversary of John Knox, by then abbot of what had become rather dubiously the Scottish Benedictine monastery at Regensburg, wrote what he called, in Latin, a skirmish against George Buchanan, an attempt to refute the radical political doctrine that had been expounded by George Buchanan in his dialogue De Jure Regni Apud Scotus. But Winyat, concerned though he was to rebut a theory which culminated in the justification of tyrannicide by private citizens, had no mind to argue that the royal authority he was seeking to defend was an unlimited authority. Of course, it was limited, like all human authority, by the laws of God and of nature. But it was also limited in ways that are more relevant to us here. It was limited by certain rules or laws which Winyat explicitly calls the leges politicae, the politic laws, the loi politique. Laws which impose upon the king or the ruler or the ruling group what we would call constitutional limits. I'm not going to deal at all, certainly not at this stage, with the problem of how such rules are to be enforced. What I want to emphasize is that here in a forgotten minor political writer of the late 16th century, we have quite simply an assumption that in any well-ordered realm, there must be laws of this kind, there must be fundamental norms of this kind to govern to define the polity, to determine what Winyat calls the status regni, the state of the realm, which is equivalent effectively to the state of the commonwealth, the status rei publicae, which establish and sustain an institutional framework within which all political power, including the supreme power that belongs to the king, must be exercised if it is to avoid degenerating into misrule and ultimately into tyranny. So here was, as I saw it, an early instance of the deliberate use of this term, politic laws, leges politicae, to define what looked extremely like what we would understand by constitutional law. Now, the lineage of ideas of that kind is not hard to determine. The roots of such ideas lie in a way of thinking about political authority that was widely current in the medieval period, and which had achieved a particularly wide currency and influence during the ecclesiological controversies and conflicts of the 15th and 16th centuries. And it's in writings of that kind that we encounter the terms libera communitas and liber populus. In particular, I want to draw your attention to some of the political ideas in that tradition that were developed primarily, though not exclusively, to justify the authority of councils over popes and the church, developed in the early 16th century by John Mayer, from whom I directly took the phrase I've used as my title. Now, Mayer was the leading theologian in the University of Paris during the second and third decades of the 16th century. He also taught in two of the Scottish universities. It can't be shown, I'm sorry to say, that his ideas directly influenced Wynyard, whose tract against Buchanan I've quoted, but what can be said is that the way of thinking that Mayer's writings represent is one that was continued vigorously into and beyond the post-Reformation controversy, which did so much to shape the long-running debate between constitutionalism and absolutism. For John Mayer, and for those who preceded and followed him in that tradition, political power is differentiated from all other forms of human authority by its being based, grounded in the consent of the community. And that consent has been given conditionally, not absolutely or irrevocably. Rulers, however extensive their power may be, and Mayer is not opposed to a wide-ranging governmental competence, but however wide their authority may be, rulers, individuals or ruling groups, do not enjoy a monopoly of political power in a properly constituted and ordered political society. There are, Mayer expressly says, two powers in such a society. There is the power of the ruler or ruling group, and there is the power of the community. And the latter, he says, is superior et illimitator. It is superior to and more unlimited than the power of the ruler. Again, of course, it cannot be totally unlimited, but in its strictly human context, this community power may properly be called supreme. And Mayer, in fact, describes it as suprema fontalis potestas inabrogabilis. In other words, the community possesses a supreme and inalienable power, which is also fontalis. Now, fontalis, I find, is a word that's virtually untranslatable, and yet the meaning is perfectly clear. It means that the community, the whole body of the realm, the populace, the people, are, or is, if you prefer to keep it in the singular, the fons or source of all other authority in the state. And it seems to me clear, and I hope I've made it clear, that such a concept is crucial to my argument, because what I'm suggesting is that such a power, suprema potestas inabrogabilis, fontalis inabrogabilis, is in substance, if not in name, a constituent power. Now, it's necessary, clearly, to look, even in the restricted context of this lecture, rather more closely at what community power in this sense actually involves. It's relevant, but it can hardly be sufficient to point out that Mayer and his followers and his predecessors do indeed say that a free people, a liber populus, a libera communitas, can change the constitution. In one of Mayer's formulations, populus autem liber pro rationabili causa potest politiam mutare. I'm going to leave that statement, however, for later consideration when I come more directly, not so much to constituent power as such, as to the problem which I think constituent power poses. So let me draw your attention to other aspects of community power. Their powers include the ultimate sanction in the system, the right to call to account and, if necessary, to depose a ruler whose rule has become incorrigibly and intolerably tyrannical. And this gives Mayer his place, of course, in the development and transmission of a resistance theory which has had its part to play in our own time. But if we think, as I suppose we are bound to think in that context, of the July plot against Adolf Hitler, it is worth noting that Mayer is completely and consistently opposed to the doctrine of tyrannicide. Deposition, judgment, all the rest of it, that's fine. Tyrannicide he rules out. In any case, the ultima ratio, the final sanction, is only the last resort, and Mayer has a lot more in mind when he ascribes this supreme power to the community. He says, for example, and this is crucial for my argument, that the community is entitled to impose binding laws upon the ruler. Now, he doesn't, at least I've been looking for nearly 50 years and I haven't found it, he doesn't actually call these laws leges politicae. He calls them, rather unhelpfully, leges regni, which could clearly refer to any laws of the realm, though I believe that in this context, Mayer does mean to refer to what others were to call the jus regni. When, for example, if I may illustrate that last phrase, when Sir James Whitlock said in the English Parliament of 1610, or referred in the English Parliament of 1610, to the natural frame and constitution of the policy of this realm, of this kingdom, which is jus publicum regni and the fundamental law of the realm. Thus bringing together in a rich mosaic the terminology of a way of thinking which seems to me to be essentially continuous with the way of thinking that one finds in earlier scholastic writers like Mayer. It was indeed with the public law, the fundamental public law of the realm, that Mayer was concerned. And he is, it seems to me, insisting that in some sense such a law can be made only by the people, the community, which enjoys this supreme, ultimate authority. And those laws define, as I've said already, but I want to repeat it, the status regni, the whole state of the kingdom, which is also the whole state or estate of the Commonwealth, of the res publica. Now, it was, as I've just said, it was for the people, the communitas, the community of the realm, to make such laws. That is quite clear. In the real world, so to speak, of late medieval and early modern politics, such laws would, of course, have been essentially customary in their character and origin. Habitual usage was, of course, accepted as one of the ways, perhaps the most important way, in which a people could make law for itself. But it was not the only way. And indeed, in the critical situations which a theory like Mayer's is meant to confront, custom alone would not suffice. If a ruler is to be deposed, or if, to take the case that's most immediately relevant here, if the constitution, the polity, is to be changed, then custom, clearly, it will not do the job for you. And this, I think, brings us to at least a beginning of seeing what the problem of constituent power is. What does it actually mean to say that a whole people, a whole community, has a power of this kind? How can one clarify, elucidate that statement? For Mayer, and I suppose for anybody before and since who's thought about the problem, the answer has to lie in representation. And that indeed is where Mayer finds the answer. The power that he's referring to is vested in the community. but it is a power that cannot be exercised directly. It must be exercised, in his language, virtualiter, that is to say, by persons or bodies who act on behalf of the community as a whole, so that it's those representatives who wield what I've been calling constituent power, according to this kind of argument. Now, I suspect that for us, that alleged solution is itself a problem. But I want to point out that for Mayer and his contemporaries, it was largely unproblematic. And to illustrate this, I want to make that brief excursion back 100 years or so to the early 15th century, and to look at a French jurist known to history only as the author of a tract or pamphlet against rebellion, Jean de Tervermeil. Now, Jean de Tervermeil, although he was in fact writing strongly in favor of royal power, nevertheless insisted that the authority of rulers and the authority, above all, of custom is derived from the consent of the community, from the consent of the people. And that consent is given through the instrumentality of the estates of the realm. For thinkers like Tervermeil and for Mayer 100 years later, there was no problem about representation because the community of the realm was present in, embodied in the estates. And it was therefore the estates who would act in critical situations where corporate action of that kind, emergency corporate action of that kind, had to be taken. Now, of course, there are problems here. For John Mayer, if I may just mention this in passing, there were particular problems because he wanted to find the same model of community power expressed through a representative body and ultimately a body that exercised supremacy over the ruler. He wanted to find this model in the church as well as in the secular realm. But these complications needn't detain us. Our problems lie elsewhere. And there are, I want to suggest, still very serious problems for us to consider. But before I consider them, I want to point out, or at least to argue, that the tradition on which writers like Mayer are relying was notably tough and durable. It was not something that was easily uprooted or broken. So long as any substantial degree of continuity with the past could be assumed or taken for granted, then the arguments that Mayer was using about the realm, the estates of the realm, would hold water and would carry conviction. The state, as we would call it, the community of the realm, which was what, if there was a state, constituted the state in that period, the community of the realm subsisted, you could say, organically in the estates, whose assembly was merely an occasional manifestation of their organic and ongoing life as corporate elements in a larger whole. Upheavals, dynastic upheavals, civil war, social change, ecclesiastical variations, none of these affected, for instance, Richard Hooker's conviction at the end of the 16th century that the Parliament of England is even the body of the whole realm. All the king's subjects, he said, all are there present. Of course, the more drastic interruption of continuity in the mid-17th century created problems and incidentally gave rise to early experiments in constitution making. But it was a brief interruption. When we come to the revolution of 1688, then indeed you may well argue that the problem of continuity and discontinuity was in some ways acute. Opinions could and did differ, in Bolingbroke's words, different views could be taken as to whether the revolution altered our old constitution for the better or restored it, brought it back to its first principles and nearer to the primitive institution. The whole matter had for many people in any case been complicated and made more difficult by the fact that by then 100 years of an ideology of divine right, indefeasible divine right, hereditary kingship, made 1688 look like an irremediable breach in the continuity which alone conferred legitimacy. But there were those who found ways of remedying the irremediable, who could represent to themselves and to others the break as being merely a crack that could be papered over. And if the papering of 1688 to 89 looked even thinner with the Hanoverian succession in 1714, it was still possible for a Bolingbroke to say, to argue, to convince himself or to profess to believe that nevertheless what the revolution did in 1688 was essentially to preserve or to restore and preserve the immemorial fabric of the realm. Nevertheless, I think it is still true to say that what happened in England between 1688 and 1714, and in Scotland, and from 1707 onwards in the United Kingdom, that what happened then does mark a significant watershed. When I first studied problems of this kind, the conventional view was that that was the period which saw the definitive emergence of a doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty that had no place, no room, for the kind of constitutional supremacy that was to prevail in due course in the United States of America. From Blackstone through Austin to Dicey, the high road was clear and straightforward, unblocked by any obstacles of that kind. But if one considers the constitutional discourse and debates of the Augustan period, one finds a much less monolithic period, monolithic picture. The Septennial Act of 1716, which, as I hardly need to remind people in this institution, extended the life of Parliament, not only of future parliaments, from 3 to 7 years, but extended the life of the Parliament then sitting from 3 to 7 years. And many of you will recall that to Tom Paine, at the end of the 18th century, this was the definitive proof that Great Britain had no constitution. Now, Bolingbroke also was persuaded of the enormity of that act. He described it as something that would have seemed strange and monstrous to those patriots who remembered long parliaments. But it was not, for him, a proof that there was no constitution. It was, quite simply, an unconstitutional use of parliamentary power. And I want to emphasize the fact that, so far as I can find, the words constitutional and unconstitutional were first used to designate conformity with, or the lack of conformity with, the fundamental rules of the political system in the pages of Bolingbroke's periodical, The Craftsman, by himself and by his colleagues. Now, it's proper to ask, given my subject at this point, what about constituent power in all this? Well, I think the answer is tolerably clear. Bolingbroke says explicitly, referring to the revolution of 1688-89, and I quote, "This establishment is founded on the principles of liberty. It was made by the people of Great Britain to ensure the possession of their liberty as well as their religion." Now, this is not to be seen simply as an isolated once-for-all act by a body which subsequently becomes passive and inert. The Constitution may be subverted by misrule on the part of the King or of Parliament, or of King, Lords and Commons acting together in breach of the trust that the people have placed in them. And that trust, according to Bolingbroke, is established by a dual contract, a contract between prince and people and a contract, and this is for my purposes a crucial phrase, a contract between the collective and the representative body of the nation. And in the last resort, Bolingbroke's view is, and I quote him again, if the constitution was actually dissolved, the people would return to their original, their natural right, the right of restoring the same constitution or of making a new one. No power on earth could claim the right of, could claim any right of imposing a constitution upon them. So the people of Great Britain, a free people, Bolingbroke explicitly calls them, have the right and the power, in John Mayer's words, two centuries before, to alter the polity, to change the constitution. Of course, there are unresolved issues here, and in particular, I want to come back in due course to that distinction between the representative and the collective bodies of the nation. But for the moment, I want to move on, and at the same time to move back to the point at which I began my historical exploration of the theme in this lecture. With Bolingbroke, we have crossed the threshold of the Enlightenment. I don't want to get involved in questions about influence, which are always difficult. I simply want to suggest that there are affinities to be noticed here that indicate ways in which political thinking and political discourse were moving in 18th century Europe. I begin with a point which I suppose one shouldn't stretch too much, but I think it may be significant. At least I mention it. It seemed to me striking to find that Bolingbroke, writing in the second quarter of the 18th century, was already using as more or less synonymous terms the word people and the word nation. Now, this is obviously not the place to embark on an investigation of the way that term nation was used in the thinking and writing of the Enlightenment. That would require not just a lecture, but a course of lectures to itself. But I do want to emphasize the point that it's clear that in this period, in the middle of the 18th century, the concept of the nation is becoming associated with the concept of fundamental constitutional law. And to illustrate this, I come back to Burlamaqui, who wrote in the work I refer to, The Principles of Politic Law, the Principes du droit politique, as follows. The fundamental laws of the state, taken in the broadest sense, are not only ordinances whereby the whole body of the nation determines what the form of government is to be and how succession to the crown shall proceed, they are also agreements, the French word there is convention, they are also agreements between the people and the prince, or between the people and the person or persons on whom it bestows the sovereignty, which regulate the way in which government is to be carried on and by means of which limits are set to the sovereign authority. Commenting on that passage, De Ratay, whom I've already quoted, remarked that this means that laws of this kind must be, in his words, I translate, inscribed in a constitutional text. If that is right, then here, by the middle of the 18th century, we have clearly adumbrated or foreshadowed the notion of a written constitution established by the constituent power of the nation as a body. Philadelphia in 1787, Paris in 1791, are only just below the horizon, if indeed they are below the horizon at all. But before I move to, and indeed somewhat beyond that horizon, I want to return briefly, or to recall briefly, two witnesses whom I brought onto the stand at an earlier stage. The first of these is Bentham. Now, Bentham is not, I think, a figure with whom one readily associates the notion of the nation, the concept of the nation as such. And yet, in the manuscripts that I referred to earlier, where he's talking about what he would have preferred to call constitutional law, he refers to certain privileges or rights, including, I may say, the right to bear arms, which have been granted or reserved to what he calls in his French the masse originaire de la nation, the originate, difficult to translate, the originating mass of the nation, or some such thing. Now, he doesn't at that point explore the processes that would be involved in this, but it's clear, it seems to me, that he is attributing, ascribing to the whole body of the nation, to the mass of the nation, a power and authority which he describes as originaire. And that surely comes notably close to what John Mayer meant in the early 16th century by describing the power of the community as fontalis. It may be worth noting also, just in passing, that writing very slightly earlier and writing in English and explicitly referring to constitutional law in so many words, Bentham refers to certain elements in that law as amounting to a sort of treaties, that's the plural of treaty, a sort of treaties with the people. Now there's an ambiguity there which is not peculiar to Bentham, an ambiguity which I believe reflects the inchoate state of thinking about constitutions, constitution-making, and constitutional law. It was to be statesmen at work rather than theorists who would definitively establish constituent power as the source of constitutional law. My second recalled witness is, as you might perhaps have guessed, Rousseau. And in spite of my undertaking, if it was that, not to flog dead horses or pursue wild geese, I can't resist going back to the issue which, among others, found Maurice Grandison and myself on opposite sides. I think the case for arguing that the droit politique with which Rousseau was concerned in his Du Contrat Social can be equated with constitutional law is supported, sustained, moved forward by looking at the evidence of the original draft of that book in the so-called Manuscrit de Genève. There, eventually, Rousseau used as a subtitle Essai sur la forme de la République. Previously, playing around with alternatives, he'd thought of Essai sur la constitution de l'État or Essai sur la formation du corps politique, the body politic, or Essai sur la formation de l'État. And moreover, both in that early draft and in the final text, when he says law under three headings, political, civil, and criminal, he says that his main concern, indeed his only concern at this stage, is with the first of these, with loi politique, with laws which, in his terms, regulate the action of the body politic, the whole body politic upon itself, regulate the relationship of the sovereign to the state. And he notes, in passing, that these laws are indeed often referred to as fundamental laws. Now, having said that, I must come back to my central question, the problem of constituent power. Does Rousseau contribute to our understanding of constituent power and its problems? I think he does, though he does it in a characteristically problematic way. The political society that Rousseau puts before us is surely and quintessentially a libera communitas, a free community, a free society. The sovereign power in such a society is and must be vested in the people, in the whole body of the citizens, whose general will is the only legitimate source of law, of all law. And that incidentally means that Rousseau must be critical, as he is, of giving the term fundamental as a special label, as it were, to attach to constitutional law. But on the other hand, what Rousseau is talking about when he talks about law is surely something very different when he talks about the making of law. Is surely something very different from what we ordinarily know and experience as the product of our own legislative institutions, most of which, or much of which, I think, in Rousseau's state, would have been the subject not of law at all, but of decrees. Laws, properly speaking, Rousseau says, are merely, or simply, the conditions of civil association. Now, those conditions would no doubt extend further and cut deeper than what we ordinarily think of as constitutional law. But I'm quite convinced that constitutional law, the basic principles of constitutional law, were for Rousseau an essential and important part of those conditions of civil association. So, that, if that is so, And I believe it's confirmed by the fact that in the definitive text of the work, that sentence I've just quoted, laws properly so called are simply the conditions of civil association, comes at the beginning of the paragraph which leads up to the celebrated chapter on the legislator. Now, Rousseau's legislator or lawgiver must, I think, be considered in the context of what I'm trying to discuss in this lecture. Because whatever else we're to make of him, and many people have made many different things, he is surely, or appears to be in some sense, a founding father, a constitution maker, guided in his task by an understanding of its demands, which is both godlike and shaped, formed by a careful reading of Montesquieu. He is to design institutions, to draft a constitution in which the community, a constitution which will combine the principles of justice and the common good with an empirical grasp of the specific conditions under which the people who are to live under the system find themselves. That, I take it, is what the legislator is supposed to do. And I believe that I'm entitled, I was justified in using the term draft when I talked about drafting a constitution. What I was not entitled to do, where I went beyond what Rousseau would allow, is when I said that the legislator is a constitution maker, because to make law is precisely what he may not, cannot legitimately do. Law can only be made by the whole body of the citizens in assembly exercising their general will. And if that is so, they act as a body, they act as a society, and that society does not subsist in virtue of a constitution which is still to be made. It exists, of course, on the basis of a contract whereby every individual has made a voluntary but total surrender to the whole body and ultimately to the sovereignty of the general will. Well, it's over 50 years since I first tried to understand that argument, and I still have somewhere the undergraduate essay that emerged from that endeavour. I doubt whether I could now write anything that would merit a better mark than I received then. Luckily for all concerned, I don't need to try. What I do need to do, or what I want to do, is rather to argue that the paradoxes, real or apparent, in Rousseau's theory do throw light on the problem of constituent power. Now, the essence of that problem, as I've already suggested, but I recapitulate the point now, the essence of that problem is simply this. If we commit ourselves to Bolingbroke's proposition that no power on earth could claim the right to impose a constitution upon a free people, then we must somehow give what philosophers in my day used to call cash value to another consequential proposition, namely that such a people possesses collectively the power to make and change its constitution. And cash is available only on two conditions. First of all, we must show grounds for postulating, or we must be able to point to, the actual existence, the prior existence of a people who can be the subject of that proposition. And secondly, of course, we must be able to point to the instrumentalities through which they can exercise the power that the proposition attributes to them. And here, I think, is where one sees the full force of the point I tried to make earlier about the unproblematic situation in which writers like Mayer found themselves. Because they could take for granted, they could assume the existence of the peoples or communities to which their principles were to apply. They could even claim divine authority for that assumption. Of course, in the case of the church, there were special problems, just as there was an especially sacrosanct origin to consider. But even in the secular realm, someone like John Mayer's pupil, Jacques Almin, could say that God and nature had both conferred the temporal sword, jurisdictional authority, upon the community. I'm tempted to exclaim, how different from us. And yet it isn't simply a matter of distinguishing or differentiating between medieval communities, which could look all right to divine authority, but also to the authority of immemorial custom, differentiating between such communities and modern, to say nothing of postmodern societies, which lack that comforting facility. The French Revolution of 1789, and I proceed on the basis that that is still part of modern history, though I sometimes wonder nowadays where modern history is supposed to have begun. The French Revolution inaugurated a whole series of constitutional-making experiments. And yet it could be and was assumed throughout, so far as I can see, that all these experiments were the work, were the acts of a nation, la nation, whose existence, whose corporate existence, was taken for granted, just as much as the existence of the community of the realm could be taken for granted and was taken for granted in the 16th century. Indeed, in a sense, though perhaps I'm pushing the argument too far, in a sense you could say that the nation was, the French nation was, the community of the realm of France, manifesting itself in a new form and using its right as a free people to change the constitution. Indeed, the first steps, after all, were taken in the traditional assembly of the States General, the three estates, and I think I am really stretching things now, but I'll say it just the same. It is, I think, of interest that one of the key works of that period is the attempt by the Abbé Sieyès to answer the question, what is the third estate? Now, if we leave France there, and turn to the other, the more durable major monument of late 18th century constitution making, if we move from Paris to Philadelphia, then it seems to me we encounter an even sharper break with the past. The opening words of the Constitution of 1787, "We, the people of the United States," refers to an entity which had as such no previous history. Even its prehistory, I suggest, could hardly be traced back further than the Articles of Confederation of 1778, or perhaps the Declaration of Independence of 1776. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood here. I'm not suggesting that those who made the constitutions of the newly independent states and who made in 1787 a constitution for the union of those states, which was intended to endure for ages to come, I'm not suggesting that they wrote the texts they devised upon a tabula rasa, upon a clean slate. They wrote, in fact, upon palimpsests, and on those palimpsests, other texts showed through, notably, for instance, the text of the English common law tradition. Showed through, and shows through still, indeed, sometimes to an extent that suggests that that tradition has survived more fully and integrally in America than it has in the country where the tradition first developed. But, in other words, what I'm acknowledging here is that many of what Rousseau would have called the conditions of civil association in the new America were inherited from the colonial past. But that, I believe, does not affect the main point I want to make. In crucial areas, in areas of crucial political importance, the constitution makers at Philadelphia both intended and achieved the creation of new institutions and defined and described and devised new relationships between and among those institutions, institutions and relationships which were not and could not be a simple continuation or even an organic development from tradition and custom. Now, how all this was done in the name of the people of the United States by persons who claimed to represent that people. In other words, I don't want another word there, I want something different. The question I want to ask is this. Is this a case where, to use Bolingbroke's terms, the collective body of the nation existed only in and by the act of the representative body? Perhaps indeed we can't even assume that the nature of the assertion of the existence of that body was universally accepted by those who were involved in it and affected by it, or that those who did accept it were united in their understanding of it. Obvious examples. One can't suppose that the three authors of the Federalist Papers had the same view of the nature and destiny of the people of the United States, or that Thomas Jefferson and John Marshall had the same understanding of it. Marshall, indeed, not only believed in the existence, I suppose, but in a sense in the supremacy of the national body. That's abundantly clear. But it's at least as clear, I take it, that a generation or so later, John C. Calhoun did not accept it. Now, in saying all this, I'm approaching, which I may sum up by saying that in a case like that, a constitutional assertion had been made, the meaning and implications of which, however, remained to be worked out, and perhaps indeed still do remain for further working out. And this brings me to the last part of what I want to say. As I approach it, I feel that you may well think that my last is what I have failed to stick to, but nevertheless, I will, if you'll bear with me, pursue a little further and in a rather different direction the issues that I've tried, perhaps too cryptically, to raise in these last few paragraphs. In the 19th century, as the 19th century unfolded and gave way to the 20th, first of all in Europe and then in non-European societies which had experienced colonial or semi-colonial status, a similar pattern of events seems to me to have developed. The existence of a people, often within boundaries defined entirely by the arbitrary accident of the distribution of power at a particular time, the existence of a people is asserted. It's asserted by having been asserted, what happens then is that founding fathers from within, or vigorous foster fathers from outside, endowed with more or less charismatic quality, motivated, driven by all the motives, good and bad, that characterize our flawed human condition, come in and fashion a constitution in the name of and on behalf of these free people. Now, you might well suppose, and it would be reasonable to expect, that that is a preamble to a Jeremiad about the results of all that. But Jeremiah is not my role tonight. I don't want to suggest either that the results of these processes, these constituent processes, have been uniformly bad, or indeed that in most cases there was any seriously viable alternative to what was done. But I do want to recall what none of us is in fact likely to forget, that we need look no further than what we now have to call former Yugoslavia to see how far an ill-judged act of constituent power three quarters of a century ago has taken us from the image of a free people shaping its own constitution and its own political destiny to the realities of ethnic cleansing. Last of all, I want to say just a little, to take a few steps to avoid falling into the error of Mr. Podsnap. Other nations do. We are sorry to be obliged to say it, as they do. Should we, or should we not? Shall we, or shall we not do the same? For most of my lifetime, it would have seemed absurd to suggest that the British people would ever engage in anything as un-British as constitution making. Yet, perhaps things are now different. Serious people are asking seriously, or raising seriously, the question of our need for a written constitution. And in the light of what I've tried to argue in this lecture, perhaps the omens for that process are not entirely unfavorable. It would certainly have the what Yeats called the fascination of what's difficult. But would it not simply be a matter of devising a summary of what has been called, after all, the law and custom of the Constitution, entrenching it and providing for its revision as relates to its amendment? And should we not have available to us the wisdom of a number of simulacra of Rousseau's legislator, not least those who adorn the judicial bench and preside over royal commissions and so on? Well, it may be so. But it seems to me that if this is the way that things are to go, there is a question to be asked. Where in all this does the free people come into the picture? Are we, in fact, the kind of cohesive body politic which could generate a modern equivalent of what Burke called a true natural aristocracy, who could undertake to shape a constitution for us in terms that we could freely accept? During the recent Victory in Europe celebrations, it was easy, certainly for people of my generation, to believe that such a body politic did still subsist. But when I waked, as the poet says, it was not so, or at least I couldn't convince myself completely that it was. I won't labour the obvious by pointing to the phenomenon of radical division in a part of the United Kingdom where the very concept of unionism is itself divisive. But I will allow myself to draw at this final moment on my own ethnic origins. You don't have to be a member, as I was 50 years ago and more, of the Scottish National Party to recognise that there are serious problems of political alienation within our existing political structure, within our existing constitutional structure. It may be possible, it may even be necessary to ask who or what or which is the free people who have the right to change the polity. And there may be a more perplexing question still, perplexing problem which also perhaps raises issues about freedom of the kind with which Maurice Cranstoun was concerned. Do we really want to take up the burden of autonomy and self-determination? Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor will not allow us to ignore this, the most searching question of all.
For the government department, just three things very briefly. The first, of course, is to thank Professor Burns for such a splendid, scholarly, stimulating, and so appropriate talk. It was exactly the kind of combination of scholarship in a domestic atmosphere that we wanted. The second thing is to thank Fred Rosen for helping this. My predecessor, Brian Barry, initiated this process, but the form and the organisation of it wouldn't have been possible without Fred, and we thank Fred making this possible. And the third thing is to thank you all for coming and making it such a friendly and appropriate atmosphere. Your reward, if reward it is some modest refreshment at the far end of the room in which I hope you'll join us now. Thank you.